In today's episode, we examine writing so strong that there's clearly vibranium in every word. Howdy, I'm Jeff Goldsmith, and this is the Q&A. My agenda is simple. Each week, I plan to bring you in-depth insights into the creative process of storytelling. Folks, I was quite excited to screen today's film, and it was a blast having co-writer Joe Robert Cole join me for a Q&A about his fantastic flick, Black Panther. As you well know, Black Panther is one of those films that really connected with audiences worldwide, and its story paints such a rich mythology of not only its protagonist, but also his complex and beautiful home that the film is just a pleasure to watch. Of course, some congrats are in order. When I interviewed Joe, he had just been WGA nominated, and today Black Panther received an Oscar nomination for Best Picture, making it the first comic book film ever nominated for Best Picture. So congrats to Joe and, of course, writer-director Ryan Coogler and all the folks at Marvel and Disney for that amazing accomplishment as well. Without a doubt, this was quite a fun chat, and Joe was very forthcoming about his creative process, so I know you'll dig this episode. And speaking of things to dig, how's about saving 10% off your application fee at screencraft.org? That's right, the fine folks at Screencraft are dedicated to helping screenwriters and filmmakers succeed, and we are pleased to have them as a sponsor for today's episode. So, you can learn all about the 2019 Screencraft Screenwriting Fellowship at screencraft.org. Past Screencraft Fellowship winners have been hired to write on Netflix shows, sold projects to top studios, and signed with literary agents at top agencies including CAA, WME, UTA, and Paradigm Talent Agency. The Screencraft team is also looking forward to reading your screenplay, because if you're shooting your own film, the Screencraft Film Fund offers up to $30,000 in production financing, not once, but twice a year to emerging filmmakers. All you need to do to save 10% on your application fee is to use promo code QAPODCAST, that's QAPODCAST, all one word, to save 10% on your application fee. And remember, you can learn all about the Screencraft Screenwriting Fellowship and their competitions at screencraft.org. And while you're surfing around online, I hope you also check out Backstory.net, where you can read issue 35 of Backstory magazine, and it features a Vice cover story with writer-director Adam McKay. He takes us behind the scenes in a 4,600-word, spoiler-specific interview all about his truly original script and the making of this fantastic film. In honor of Mission Impossible Fallout hitting home video, good old Christopher McQuarrie shared some of the cool storyboards from the film so you could get an idea of the kind of visual prep he was walking into these sequences with, and I know you'll dig looking at them. Plus, issue 35 also has in-depth articles on Aquaman, Mary Poppins Returns, and our huge Nickel Fellowship piece where we meet the 2018 winners, and in our Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse piece, not only did we interview Rodney Rothman, but also his co-writer Phil Lord, and it's a really fun interview. Plus so much more, so I hope you look at the table of contents so you can see everything that's inside issue 35, and if you like what you see, I hope you consider subscribing. If you're on the fence, you could read issue number one, the free issue, and test drive us at backstory.net as well, so I hope you'll check it out. And hey, if you're in LA or going to visit LA, make sure to sign up for my screening series so you could come to these events, as we're happy to have you. You could sign up to get on the free email list at backstory.net/events, so I hope to see you at a screening sometime soon. But now, without any further ado, let's jump onto the stage at the American Film Institute right after I introduced co-writer Joe Robert Cole to chat about his WGA and Oscar-nominated film, Black Panther. All right. Well, so as we're sitting here at AFI, I would be remiss if I didn't ask, were you formally educated? Did you go to film school or any such thing like that?
I have a film theory degree, so no. I went to Berkeley.
Berkeley? Okay. Okay.
So there's a bunch of people pontificating about about movies. Not so much learning how to make them.
but it helped you for film theory, right? Or would you say it was a waste of time?
No, it wasn't a waste. No. It helped me to be able to look at film in a critical way and understand them. But you know, making movies is a practical act as well, so there's two sides of it. So, you know, if you go to school at a theory school, you got to get your production and that kind of experience outside of it. So,
what'd you do when you graduated? Because there's nothing more traumatic for a person than studying film and then graduating and going out into the real world. So, what happened?
I'm a bit of a workaholic, and so I when I was in school, I decided I wanted to try to tell stories. And so when I was a freshman, I got Sid Field's screenplay book from a bookstore, and I had just been writing a ton while I was in school. And so I came down here and, you know, had some specs and was trying to hustle and do the thing that everybody else does.
So what was your breaking in moment? When was the first time that you were, quote unquote, paid for it?
I wrote the shooting draft of ATL in 2006. That was my first thing.
Right, and it was uncredited work, to
yeah,
my
it was
knowledge?
Yeah, it was uncredited.
Because
yeah.
of a WGA arbitration.
Yeah.
Fun,
you
right?
Know, you know that. Oh.
That's fun for your first job, huh?
I'm not going to get into that at all.
No. I know.
It was a great experience. I was able to, they took me down to Atlanta. It was great for me. And I was proud of the movie. I was proud of the work that I did on it. And it was a fun movie. So yeah, that was my first thing.
A big learning experience for you was your writing directing debut, 2011's Amber
yeah.
Lake.
Yeah.
And you know, just take us, I want to get into Black Panther in a second,
sure.
but tell us what was kind of the eye-opening things on the path of, you know, such a big achievement to have your first writing directing debut.
It's an experimental film. And so my now wife, girlfriend at the time, we were, wife at the time. What am I saying? When did we do that?
Now there's
yes,
trouble.
Yes, there's a wife. No, we were, she's an actress, and she's a member of the Actors Studio, and she would have some of her friends come over and they would work on scenes. And I would direct the scenes, and I had been telling, you know, people, you know, I want to direct. And it's very difficult to say you want to direct unless you're actually directing. And so we did a few scenes and we all decided, you know what, we're just going to try to do a movie. And we literally voted on every aspect of the movie. And we...
That's unusual.
Like, it's totally experimental. It was like what was the genre? What was the, we kind of pitch stories and then vote on which ones we wanted. And then I set up like beats for each scene and then we improv them. I recorded the improvs and then I literally wrote the script based on improvs.
How long did that take? That sounds like an intensive process.
I don't know, a few months,
okay.
A few months. And then, you know, we did it for $50,000.
Which is fantastic.
Yeah, we just went up and, you know, and it was something, it was for all of us an exercise in trying to storytell. You know, how, you know, what is the, let's get out and do instead of talk about, you know.
For all the planning, for all the things that you thought you knew, what was something that was really eye-opening about Amber Lake that kind of helped you as an artist, as a creator, moving forward afterwards?
You know, that's good. It's a good question. I found that I really just enjoyed that aspect of storytelling as much. I love writing. I love making stories. It's the thing that's kind of been the one constant in my life since I was a kid. I used to play a lot of make-believe. I'm an only child. And, you know, there's more tools in the toolbox. And so when you're directing, and so I found that I really enjoyed the craft. It was something that I assumed that I would like, because I had done a few little shorts and things of that nature. But you know, when you shoot a feature in 10.5 days, it's pretty intensive process. So I feel like that's the biggest thing that I got out of it.
Like every good writer, you seem to have some scripts that people adore that have been unproduced.
Yeah.
And to my knowledge, there was a cop drama of some sort that caught Marvel's eye.
Yeah.
What was the title and what was the pitch? What would you tell us that script was?
It is, it's called Virtue, and it's kind of a Chinatown, script about a Black Republican police lieutenant and
here. Say those words again. Sorry.
Black Republican police lieutenant in Los Angeles.
Oh, it's sci-fi. Okay,
yes.
Cool.
And you know, the whole film rains in LA. The whole movie it rains until he has a breakthrough, and then the sun comes out.
Nice, nice.
So that's about as sci-fi as I can get on it. But yeah, they got a hold of that, and I went in for a general with them and had a great meeting. And they were going to do a They were thinking about doing a roadie movie, a movie for
War Machine.
War Machine. And so I ultimately pitched and won that job. I pitched all the way up to Kevin Feige and won that job. And then they decided shortly after, like within weeks, they had hired Shane Black to do Iron Man 3. And he wanted to have War Machine, from what I understand, have a bigger part in that. So as you know, all of Marvel movies connect. And so it was a little bit of like, well, we're not sure how this is going to move forward. Would you like to be in our writer program? And I didn't know it existed.
Not a lot of people do. Talk us through what it is exactly.
It is, it's kind of like a development deal. They give you an office. They give you a character and you read all the comics and then you come up with a story. You do an outline of the story that the movie you'd want to write. And you get some notes on it, and eventually they greenlight it. And then you write it, and you get some notes on it. They put an executive producer, which is, the same producers that actually produce their movies. And then you kind of just work through it, and then they get to a point, and then they go, okay, here, take another character. And you do it that way. And it's 9 months and then a 3-month hiatus, and they can up you for a second year. And so I did it a couple years.
So you have 9 months to write a script?
No, I did in two years, I did 3 movies.
Okay.
So, when they get to a point, they just stack them. They're smart.
They are smart. Well, so tell me this. So, did you get an actual War Machine script written, or did it not go that far?
No, okay. Didn't go. It literally, I got word that I got the job, and I feel like I had a week and a half of celebrating.
Oh, okay.
And then I found out it was not happening.
Well, so riddle me this. I know that there was an Inhuman script that you wrote, I believe. is that correct?
No.
Damn it.
Not correct.
Good. Let's debunk the internet right now. What was it? What were the 3 scripts that you wrote during the Marvel Writers Program?
I wonder if I can say what they were.
Oh, okay. Feige just called me.
They put a chip in your... I don't wonder if I get electrocuted.
I'm not asking the plot.
I they're making one. I can't say.
Okay, was one of them Black Panther? How about that?
No.
Really?
Okay. No, Black Panther was not a movie. I'm sorry, I can't say.
It's totally fine. We get it.
But no, Black Panther was not a movie that I worked on at all. I knew that Nate Moore, who is one of the executive producer of Black Panther, and he's one of the executives that I worked with in the writer program. I knew from just our conversation that he loved Black Panther as a kid growing up and was an advocate for the character to be incorporated in the cinematic universe. And so I read some of Christopher Priest's run just out of curiosity, and it really resonated with me, but I never worked on it in the program.
You had a very good view on the inside workings of Marvel,
yeah,
going through the process, which made them obviously comfortable with you as a writer and a good choice for Black Panther. What was something that you learned about the studio system, even in the microcosm level of working with Marvel like that? Because some writers can exist in there and some can't, and it's a tricky trail with, I'm not going to even say politics, but just the art of truly learning to accept a note and make it your own and things like that. So I'm just curious what the lessons were that you learned.
It's interesting. My experience with Marvel has been pretty fantastic, and I have found them to be quite open-minded and to be really smart note givers. And I've heard people say that it's like they've had difficulty. I can't speak to that. I can say that with Panther, for instance, Kevin's notes were be more personal. Tell the story you guys want to tell. It was never, can you not do this or not do that? Or there was no mandate of what characters, we were supposed to use. We were able to change Nakia. We were able to change Killmonger. We were able to change M'Baku. So we really didn't have that kind of experience where it felt at all like we weren't all trying to do the same thing in a very collaborative way. When I was in the program, it felt the same. I mean, obviously I was younger and still trying to figure it out, and I was happy to be there and all this stuff, but the biggest thing that I felt like I learned was a greater understanding of wish fulfillment, and this idea that you come to a movie with a certain expectation, and as a viewer, and to try, particularly when you're thinking about something like a superhero movie, and to try to with whatever. Whatever version or type of movie you're making, trying to satisfy that wish fulfillment within the parameters of what you're working on. And that allows for you to have, I think, a level of creativity where your movie doesn't have to be the same movie over and over again. I think if you look at Marvel movies, they're all different types, but they all trigger the wish fulfillment. We all are looking to want to be, we're looking like, oh, I wish, like, what if I could be that? And if you can tap into that, I think you can find a way to make a successful, you know, I think film in general, that kind of empathy, but superhero movies for sure. And so I that was something that in looking at a lot of times when you'd get notes, it was looking at the note beneath the note and going, oh, and I, you know, after a while, I get where they're directing me. And it was never like, do that. It was always like, experiment with this. Try this. See if that. And those are good notes. I've gotten bad notes at places. And those are, I have not had that situation.
Of course. The debut of Black Panther in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, the MCU, was in Captain America Civil War. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, you know, because you did not write on that. Yeah. I'm curious what your observations were of seeing the first iteration of Black Panther come to the screen and then coming on for this project, for the Black Panther actual movie after the success of Civil War. Talk us through that.
Well, it was cool. I saw Civil War before it came out, you know, and I didn't know that they were gonna, you know, you hope that they'll do a standalone, and you're going, oh, it'd be great if I could be a part of. But you know, I as someone who was a part of the program and as a friend of Nate's, I got a chance to check it out, and it, you know, it excited me because, you know, in a little part of the canon that I had read in the pre-stuff, there's a certain nobility to T'Challa, a certain complexity and kind of relentlessness and the kind of, you know, doing the right thing regardless of the, regardless of your own personal feelings. There's a lot, he's constantly sacrificing, you know, for the greater good. And I felt like that existed in the arc of his character in Civil War, so I thought they did a fantastic job with it. And then you know you watch the movie and you go, wow, that character is going to really shine. But maybe I'm biased. We'll see how it plays out. And you know, and people seem to really respond to it. And so it seemed clear after it came out that they were probably going to do a standalone.
Well, it was a genius way to test the character in which they integrated him in this, you know, huge other superhero movie, mm-hmm. as the mystery element. So the audience, every second of the movie, wants to know more and more, you know, yeah. Was he behind this bomb? What's going on? And of course he's not. And, you know, it was a great thing. I know that you were writing on the People versus OJ Simpson at the time.
Yeah.
And which was fantastic, by the way.
Thank you.
I'm curious when the call came. When was it that you finally realized you were going to be working on a Black Panther movie?
When Nate Moore also is executive producer of Civil War, and so I credit him. You know, obviously you can see who tried to slide Panther in there, but we were deep in production on OJ, and I, like I said, I had an inkling that they might want to do it, but you never know with Marvel. You don't know what they're going to do. They don't share. But they reached out to my reps and you know, they get you a certain amount of information and you know, I don't know how many, I guess they went out to a few writers and you come up with a take. And so I was doing that while I was supervising. I was doing my job, you know, but I was kind of, I kept it pretty close to the vest because I truthfully really wanted an opportunity to write it and was really excited about the chance to do it and didn't want to. I was a little superstitious and didn't want to jinx it. And you know, I went in and I pitched. And
give us your pitch. What put us in the room, because you know, it's interesting.
I can't even remember. It's
Do you remember something specific about your take? Because obviously, as you said, you were against other writers. So out of curiosity, how do you think you won it? Aside from your good working past with Marvel.
I think some of the themes and some of the things that I wanted to explore in the story, I know they ended up, you know, they resonated with Ryan also, but like, I think they were looking for something that had a personal perspective that felt different than other movies that they had made. And so I think perhaps because I had been through the program and I understood the things that they might be looking for on a larger scale, right? And then from life experience, I could bring some of the more personal things, specific things that they might have been looking for the project, that might have been the reason. I can't say... Oh, it was the Busan action sequence that or the way we, you know, because so much of the movie was me and Ryan talking about, like, just having conversations about what we wanted to explore in terms of character and stuff like that. And how do you do it? Which characters? How do we want to show what Wakanda is? You know, okay, let's do it through relationships and characters. How do we want to describe T'Challa? Let's talk about it through the family and the things that he has to deal with. And, you know, how do we want our villain or our antagonist to affect him? How can we do that in personal ways? And so it was a lot of conversations starting with these kind of overarching themes that we wanted to explore. And so I think those existed and
we'll get into those for sure a little more in the spoiler section. But in this still non-spoiler section, when did you realize you were going to have a co-writer and your director, Ryan Coogler?
They let me know that they wanted me to do it. And it had to be like maybe a week after that.
Because I think
they're working on more than one track. You know what I mean? It had to be about a week, and they were like, you know, we're really having conversations with Ryan and you know, thinking he's going to want to co-write. We've had these conversations with him, and I'm a big fan of his already, and that really excited me. It was he has an amazing emotional intelligence, and all his work has it, and so and his films generally move me, you know, in a way that I was really just excited to be able to work with him. So, yeah.
Tell me about your habit when you sit down to write. How important is outlining to your habit?
I like to have some order. I like to know what my scene list is. And kind of the tent posts that I want to try to hit. And then I do a vomit draft. I just like spew out.
Before you do that, how long do you outline for? Do you
Not
give yourself
long.
No?
No, no. Once I know what I want to do and I
beginning,
know
beginning, middle, end, you got
yep,
it down.
And okay. Then I do scenes. Okay, these are the beat. These are
like a
the
beat
scenes.
Sheet in Microsoft yeah, Word type yep, of thing. Not even scripted. Okay.
No, just a beat sheet.
How long would you say that the outline process and putting it on paper took for you and Ryan for Black Panther?
It took a while because it was a lot of these conversations.
Right, it was
a lot
organic.
We're kind of figuring out, and you're world building. So it's like you're trying to. The challenge is like, how do you show, not tell? How much do you tell? You know, and there was lots of characters that we were trying to weave in. So it took a while.
Did you note card at all, or was it just all like on a paper beat sheet type of thing?
It was typing.
It
was all beat
sheets. And were you guys together every day doing
period? No, we would work on stuff and send it to each other. We'd FaceTime. We weren't always in it. We didn't work in the same room often.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You know, often movies that are big movies like this, they have a release date that it's pegged to. Did you guys have a timeline that Marvel said, look, we need your first draft by X, and then we really need to start gravitating towards a production start date of Y, et cetera? Or no?
We knew. I mean, we were writing all the way through pre-production. And so we knew it was coming. And you know, but that, I one of the things that I think Because I was writing with the director, I think he got more of those conversations than I did. So he was kind of a buffer to me in a way with some of the more kind
right.
of pragmatic things that, here we are, we're getting tight. And he's just a lovely dude. So he wasn't putting any pressure on me in that way.
When you sit down to write, and since you were saying you mostly didn't do it with Ryan, how long do you give yourself for a day's worth of work? Do you try and give yourself a certain amount of hours or a certain amount of pages?
I'm a workaholic. So I write lots of hours. And so I'll have a page count, but if I get to the page count before I'm tired, I keep writing. I just do more. And so I work until I kind of pass out.
All right. What do you do if you get writer's block? If you get it, how do you battle it?
You keep going until it feels right. I mean, that works.
There's no one way to do it. That's why I ask these same questions. Yeah. It's fascinating to hear everybody's different process.
Yeah, I just keep after it.
Well, so when you and Ryan were co-writing, you would trade scenes. Tell us how that works, because it's also hard to figure out who's keeping track of like the alpha draft, like the one big draft, and integrating this scene or deleting that scene.
We would, all right, you take a crack at the first act, or I'll do 2A, or you do this sequence and I'll do that. And then once you finish it, you send it to the other person, and then they would look at it, and then, okay, you rewrite over it, or you write. And so it was really organic, and it didn't have to be. I really do give him a great amount of credit. There was never kind of a hierarchy. We just worked on this stuff, and you there was no egos. There was just like, all right, let's try this, let's try that. And a lot of it is trial and error and trying to figure things out. And we just go back and forth.
How long till you got your first draft done, and how many pages was it, if you remember?
That was long.
It's good to be long.
It was long.
You got to get it all out. How long was it?
It was it was above 150, I think.
Okay.
It was up there, man.
That's healthy. That's healthy for a first draft.
It was up there.
This is a complicated movie. Yeah. There's awesome casting in the movie, and everybody really filled their roles quite well. But something that really cracked me up that I'm just kind of curious about, Martin Freeman and Andy Serkis were brought in, and they have both been in J.R.R. Tolkien films, and people have kind of dubbed them the Tolkien white folks.
Oh.
And I'm curious if that was on purpose, because it's so funny to me. It's so funny to me.
I had nothing to do with casting.
Okay. All right. Good answer. We have a politician here. Last one before we get into the spoilers, what was your budget and schedule?
I think it was $200 million.
Okay.
I think that's where
that
we
sounds
were.
Right. A little more than Amber Lake, basically.
A little more than Amber Lake. I think you couldn't buy like one costume or something for my budget on my movie. But
the schedule,
I think it was 82 days.
Okay. Wow. That's tight.
Yeah. I think it was 82. I may be off by a little bit, but I think so.
All right, it would be impossible to keep going without getting into the spoilers. So podcast listeners, if for some reason you have not seen Black Panther, I don't understand how, but please press pause, go watch it, and come back. And I say I don't understand how because, for a movie that needed to be tested, this film made $700 million domestic, $600 million worldwide for a $1.3 billion cumulative box office total.
Yeah.
So congratulations on that. You really resonated with both you and Ryan's script. And we're sitting here chatting after you have both been WGA nominated.
Yeah.
So congrats on your WGA nomination as well.
Thank you so much. That's an awesome honor. It's great.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And so into the spoilers now. T'Challa's father, Wakanda's king, was killed in Civil War. And essentially what you focused on, as you hinted at earlier, is you focused on the concept of a kingdom drama.
Yeah.
And I think it was like refreshing and a surprise because the whole movie almost is world building because it takes place in Wakanda.
Yeah.
So at what point did you realize that you were going to go solely into Wakanda for so much of the movie? Yes, there's the great soul sequence, but the heart of the movie is everything that's really happening and going on in Wakanda.
Well, it was a discussion about how to introduce this new nation, right? And we talked about doing it through character. Well, most of the characters exist within, you know, within the country, and we're really wanting to find ways to show this idea that everyone there isn't monolithic, everyone doesn't think the same. We would kind of lay out, we tried to partner people with, you know, isolationists versus globalists, innovation versus tradition, and really kind of put those two people, those two characters, those specific characters into situations where through the drama of their interactions and their conversations, we could learn about, one, about T'Challa and to help his arc and his journey, but also to elucidate what Wakanda is and its history. And so it takes time to do that. And so we knew, you know, in early outlines and stuff, there were other places we thought about going, but it felt like the most bang for our buck and really being able to root ourselves and to really show what this place is and personalize it, we needed to spend time there.
Yeah, and you did an interesting setup in the preamble as well, in which you mentioned there's five tribes. One went off to the mountains and refused to join the others. So all that kept coming back over and over, and you really just kind of gave us breadcrumbs to lead us down that path. But you were saying that there were some things in your outline that were left turns. That I love hearing about left turns. Tell us some of the ideas that you had that you really, for maybe a week or a month, thought were going to be a part of a Black Panther movie that then you just didn't make it off the drafting table.
I think the biggest, we were going to travel to, you know, we were going to be in the States at a certain point.
Beyond Oakland.
We had a sequence. We're going to be in Chicago at a point to do some things there. And we, you know, it just...
What was going
to
happen in Chicago?
Oh, it was, you know, we were kind of figuring out and thinking about T'Challa's love interests, and we're in Nakia, and we're just trying, you know, we wanted to show some vulnerability with him and ways to connect with his character in a personal way. If you read the canon, he is, you know, it's hard to find any warts with him. And so we're really just trying to find those spaces and you know, use the idea of his love interest as that. And so it was a part of that process, just kind of trying to figure out what was the version of his relationship that we were going to explore. And so again, we always kept falling back, like it felt more organic and it felt more impactful and it felt like the right version of the movie to spend more time.
I was curious because he grew out of Civil War. Mm-hmm. If there was going to be anything that you had on the drafting table in an early iteration that maybe integrated some elements from Civil War.
Well, you know, because
it's not even discussed. You know, when Bucky shows up at the end, you're like, oh yeah, like he knows all the Avengers.
Yeah, we had some early just conversations, but it never got beyond. We really wanted the movie to stand on its own and to be a unique film within the universe, and not to rely on trying to lean too much on the previous films. And so we decided that to not incorporate too many elements. And I feel like if we had, we would have had to lose some of the, because we introduced so many characters. We really, you know, really wasn't that much real estate open to do too much. And so yeah, there really isn't. I mean, we knew, I mean, Bucky is there. We know that he's there from Civil War. And so we knew that that was something that we at some point might need to consider and address.
That was good you did in the tag. I had to actually explain the tag to the audience tonight because strangely, Disney sent the press version.
They didn't put it in there.
They sent the press version of the DCP, which they sometimes do to the press, in which they don't show all the end tags to the press.
Oh.
So strange, you know, him addressing the UN was there, but not Bucky.
So Bucky,
Yeah, but they got it. They got it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
but there were a couple newbies today who had never seen it before, so that was funny.
Yeah.
You know, Kevin Feige is a powerhouse of a producer. Yeah. He's a great storyteller.
Yeah.
He's really tapped in. What could you tell me, because you've worked with a lot of different producers, about some of the creative habits that you've picked up from Kevin that have kind of aided your process and you might take forward to other projects?
He's a great listener. You're in a story meeting with someone who is so successful in so many films, and he does a lot of listening, and he doesn't suck the oxygen out of the room, and he's collaborative, and he's really chill, and he's just smart. And so that kind of demeanor where you're able to kind of, it becomes a nice conversation about how do we figure this out together. That makes it all worthwhile. You know, it becomes, it's easy to hear when you're, and to communicate when you're in an environment that way. And I would say that that's something, that just working directly with him, and he's smart and he knows, like, he loves this stuff. And so he like loves comic books. He loves all of it. And that is infectious too. And that's true about, you know, Nate and all of the folks over there. They really love working in that space. And so, it's not necessarily as much a job as it is a love of what they do. So.
It's one thing to do the Black Panther standalone movie. Yeah. We expected his origin story to be clarified more, which it is, even though part of it starts, you know, in Civil War,
yeah,
per se, of him, you know, assuming his father's throne.
Right.
But the one of the surprises of many in the movie were the women of Wakanda.
Yeah.
You know, you have Okoye, you have Shuri, you have the Queen, you have Nakia.
Yeah.
How important did you realize the women were going to be? Because you wrote these very smart, strong women that really showed a high-functioning civilization, you know, that is hidden from the world, as they say in Wakanda. That was another fun surprise.
Yeah, you know, in Wakanda, there's everyone's on balance with everyone else. And that was something that we talked about very early on. This is a nation that has not been influenced by any outside nations or countries or civilizations. And so we wanted to, it gave us an opportunity to kind of start from scratch and to kind of create this kind of self-determinant nation and how we imagined it could be. And so that was kind of what we wanted to do. I mean, but you know, Ryan and I both have had wonderful women in our lives. And so, you know, I think that was also something that resonated with us on a personal level. But then there were so many, like, we leaned on, you know, that we leaned on the women that were a part of the production, Victoria, Alonzo. I mean, we are actresses, and ask questions, know what you don't know. And also our family. I like to say that my grandma's my idol, and you know, I feel like, you know, so much of the man that I am comes from me trying to emulate the woman that she was. And so that is something that we would also talk about. And he feels the same way about his family and his wife and my wife. And like, and so it was important to us. And, but we didn't do it on our own. I mean, it takes, you know, those actresses who breathe life into the characters, they had tremendous amount of input in what they were saying and how they were going about it and what they were, you know, it wasn't just me and him sitting there trying to figure it out. It was us going, let's all again do it together.
Folks, I'm jumping in really quick to pitch you about what's in the latest issue of Backstory Magazine. But before I do, I can't believe it's already been a year since we launched the desktop laptop version of Backstory Magazine over at backstory.net. You asked for it. And I took forever to build it, but finally triumphed over the technological limitations to bring you Backstory in all its glory on desktops and laptops so you can experience our awesome art direction, interactivity, and in-depth interviews. So I hope you'll support us by purchasing a single issue or a subscription at backstory.net. If you've never read us, I hope you check out the free issue over there, which is a double issue filled with great content.
You can, of course, read us on Google Play, on an Android tablet, or via our iPad app, where it all started. And the great news is, if you subscribe at Backstory.net, your login will work on all those devices. So I hope you consider digging in. Another reason why now is the perfect time to subscribe is because we just released issue 35 of Backstory with our Vice cover story. That's right, we have got a fantastic interview with writer-director Adam McKay on all the wild structuring and non-traditional writing he did on Vice. Plus, since it's Christmas, although we already did a very cool Die Hard podcast that you've probably heard by now, co-writer Stephen E. D'Souza wanted to share what he considers to be the most complete version of his Die Hard screenplay, and the only place you'll find it is in issue 35. It's 133 pages long and has all the different shooting draft color pages, so you will definitely want to check that out. Backstory issue 35 also features our huge Nickel Screenwriting Fellowship piece, where we interview this year's fellows and run excerpts from their scripts. In honor of Mission Impossible Fallout hitting home video, good old Christopher McQuarrie shared some of the cool storyboards from the film so you could get an idea of the kind of visual prep he was walking into these sequences with, and I know you'll dig looking at them. And in our Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse piece, not only did we interview writer Rodney Rothman, but also co-writer Phil Lord, and it's a really fun interview. Even cooler, since Rodney was kind enough to supply us with the script pages of his unused and hilarious Australian Spider-Man concept, you could read them in the magazine as an excerpt, and we're also putting them up there for everyone to see as a blog post at backstory.net, so you could read them there even if you're not a subscriber. Plus, we've got a huge spoiler-centric Aquaman article featuring the film's co-writers, a Mary Poppins Returns piece with writer David McGee, writer-director Barry Jenkins chats about if Beale Street could talk. You could read a full Blacklist screenplay and a full Bloodlist TV pilot, plus interviews with each of those respective writers. We also interviewed Mystery Science Theater 3000's creator Joel Hodgson and director Rob Schraub about making this season's The Gauntlet. And speaking of schlock cinema, we've got the writer-director of the newly uncovered silly ass-kicking flick Ninja Zombie. Yes, it's a lost film, and it is exactly what it sounds like. A ninja, who's also a zombie. And there's so much more in issue 35, I'm not even doing it justice, so I hope you will check out the table of contents over at Backstory.net. Look, it really means a lot to me to have my podcast listeners support my passion project, so thanks for considering. Of course, don't forget to visit our sponsor, the fine folks at ScreenCraft, and save 10% off your application fee at ScreenCraft.org by using code QAPODCAST, all one word, QA podcast at screencraft.org, and you could save 10% on your application to the ScreenCraft Film Fund, or even a chance to win the ScreenCraft Screenwriting Fellowship and sign with a top agency. So don't forget to type in QA podcast at screencraft.org to save 10% when you apply. But now let's jump back into my chat with co-writer Joe Robert Cole about his passion project, the WGA and Oscar-nominated film Black Panther.
In a superhero movie, per se, an antagonist is very important. And here you created something so nearly perfect in Killmonger. I mean, a version that really rises above the comics in a way. And it gets into the theme of Black Panther. You know, in the comic in the 70s, it was taking a way to, I don't want to say make sense of, but to echo some of the things that were going on in the Black Panther and Black Power movement that was going on in the United States, but in a positive way. Mm-hmm. And here you have a person that feels, with the knowledge that Wakanda exists, feels abandoned. And his central goal is that he wants to take the technology to arm the next generation of revolutionaries that have been underarmed in the past. Mm-hmm. And it's such a pure goal for a movie called Black Panther that echoes all the politics and everything else, but on such a simplistic level. Mm-hmm. How long did it take to kind of curate that? Because I could see Killmonger going in so many different ways, especially in a kingdom drama. You know, in Marvel, we've seen it in Thor, the way Loki reacts. It's just a power grab. But no. For Killmonger, it was different. Like, his whole life was focused on this worldwide revolution.
Yeah. Yeah, that was one of those things that early on Ryan and I connected on, the experience of, as African American men, feeling that disconnect from the continent, not knowing our history, not, you know, knowing the history that we've seen has been misrepresented, and wanting to talking about what that felt like, the frustration, anger, the confusion. And we wanted to explore also just that idea of not like not knowing, wanting to explore what is the dialogue between Africa and Africans and African Americans, and what is that? And to kind of, you know, search through that terrain. And so Killmonger, you know, we wanted to find an antagonist, a version of an antagonist that could really affect our protagonist in a meaningful way, and a personal and an emotional way. I think, you know, the best villains are those ones that can really affect your hero, right? And so we thought, making it family, what's more personal than that? What can you know, reach someone deeper than that? And so we just kept trying to figure out how do we craft this? How do we, you know, you get those little pieces and you start to try to make the connective tissue, and what is the narrative? What is the story? How do we, you know, we knew we were going to start in Oakland as a bookend of the movie, and what does that mean? And well, so we explored.
And you're redoing part of his mythology from the comics, which is tough for some writers to get away from.
Yeah.
Because they think that they need to dogmatically stick to it. And here you're rewriting it, but in a very unique fashion.
Well, yeah, they didn't give us, like I said, they did not give us a mandate on you have to use the characters as they are in the canon. They gave us an opportunity to utilize the canon as to tell the story that we wanted. And so we were able to take characters and reimagine them and use them for the purposes of the story that we wanted to tell, and we felt like he was the right version of an African American dealing with, you know, I think a better way to say it is, if I think sometimes if I knew that there was a country that could have changed everything, how would I feel about them? And how, you know, what would you, what kind of frustration and anger and that's where I'm from. And that's, you know, and so we tried to find a way to make him someone that you could connect with and, you know, understand why he feels the way he feels. Maybe his techniques and methods are what makes him a villain versus his, you know, his motivation.
But here's what's so fascinating. Aside from just having a great antagonist and giving him a great goal, you turned it up a notch, in which you made it part of a generational argument between fathers and sons that is spanning, you know, from when the time that they were children before they were aware of the argument to their final battle between Killmonger and Black Panther, in which your antagonist, because a great antagonist truly believes their goals are just and correct. They're not just evil twirling their mustache. And one way or another, here, Killmonger had an effect on Black Panther and made him change his worldview and depart from his father's isolationism. Mm-hmm. So talk about realizing that it could then permeate on that level to actually change the protagonist, even though they still have to battle. And in this case, you decided to kill Killmonger.
Yeah, Killmonger decided he needed to die.
Is that true? Was he originally going to live? And
no, I'm saying in the medicine.
Oh, okay, okay.
No,
just checking if it was an actor thing.
No.
But the father and the sons, and having the argument continue, is fascinating.
You know, in the canon, like I said, T'Challa is, it's hard to find warts. He's, you know, he's intelligent. He's handsome. He generally makes the right decision. He's, you know, he chooses the greater good. So when you're trying to find that arc, what is the thing he's overcoming? What is the thing that what is the great challenge of his, you know, of his life in the scope of our movie? It's the history of his nation. It's what's in the soil. It's what his fathers have done. It's what his ancestors have done. And how do you write that? And it goes to one of the themes that we exploring a movie, which is Am I My Brother's Keeper, which connects it to Killmonger. You know, this idea of, and so we, you know, it had to be generational. It wasn't kind of a like, oh, we can do that too. It was like, it was more of, this is something that, because of how Killmonger was conceived, his father, and it had to be kind of the history of this place, who keeps itself hidden, who isolation is its, you know, primary use of defense in a lot of ways, of not having to interact with the outside world and have the outside world see the resources it has, and you know, and that in a historical context fits wonderfully within Africa, in a place where people have constantly come from the outside and exploited their resources and not benefited the nation. So that was always of just kind of a part. It was all part of it, all, you know, from the beginning.
As an origin story, you show the purple heart-shaped herb giving power, and it was fascinating to see Killmonger want to burn it all down so no one else except him could have it.
Yeah.
Tell us about that, and also something that was really unique here, which was the visitations of the ancestral plane.
Yeah.
Because it was great for exposition, but also great for emotional beats as well.
Yeah,
it was. You're talking with the dead, essentially.
Yeah, and that's the you know, there's a connection to in some African culture. There's a connection to the spiritual realm in a way that's different, maybe, than the way we might look at it here. And so they're always that kind of exists in a the ether of what that world is.
And it wasn't something that was a big part of the comic, though, right?
No, but it was. It's something that, as an African American, that
course,
you know, exists, and that is a part of your family talks about and things like that. And so it was something that we were exploring in that context, and it did allow us to connect. Father and sons, and emotionally connect these two, our antagonists and our protagonists, in a way that that also allowed for the kind of correcting of the past wrongs that existed. So it's functional as it is. It's functional on a lot of levels. And so again, it was like, oh, let's do this. It wasn't, a lot of the stuff wasn't like, you know what? This is the perfect technique for this. It was always like, how do we, let's talk about ways to do this. Oh, maybe we should try this. Maybe we should try that. And so a lot of the stuff happened organically. And it wasn't on a board where we're kind of scratching stuff up. It's just like conversations. Let's try it and then explore it. And then some stuff you explore and it works. Some stuff you explore and it's not working. You keep cracking at it and cracking at it and, you know, so that's the way it worked.
Another interesting character was M'Baku, and you know, you wonder, is he going to be a total antagonist? Mm-hmm. Is he going to try and invade and fight Killmonger? There's so many different variants that could have happened, but he becomes an ally. You know, he yields, he loses in the beginning. It's a great setup for what happens to Black Panther and you know, his ceremony. And I'm curious when you got the idea that he was going to have this great, you know, third act surge in which he was going to show up to help save the day and unite Wakanda.
Pretty early on. When we decided we wanted to incorporate him in the movie, we, you know, when we're setting up the tribes, we felt like the ultra, you know, kind of isolationist group, the more fundamentalist group. He would be a great leader of that, and that would provide he would offer a great perspective to Wakanda. And then you're figuring out, okay, in terms of the story dynamic and the mechanics of your story, what does he service beyond just being that, you know, just representing that facet? And so you're going, well, the character that would most be beneficial to, you know, would give the most bang for your buck coming back to help would be the one who was the least supportive early on. And so it was kind of an early thing we wanted to do.
There was a little resonance that reminded me as a kind of a comic geek of Superman 2 here and there with when we're taking the power away and we're fighting like normal human men and then we're coming back with the superpower. But
Superman 2 was good, man.
I love Superman 2. Oh my God. When it was released, I saw it twice in one day. I faked out my parents. We snuck out at lunch to see the afternoon screening, even though we had tickets for the night. But nonetheless, I lost my train of thought. Here you pull this great trick in which you basically show the challenge at first that M'Baku loses, and then the thing that you think is never going to happen of Black Panther losing, it happens. Yeah. And he's in a coma state. It's going back to the kind of, you know, being buried and going back to the ancestral plane and using the last heart-shaped herb to save him. Mm-hmm. When did you realize that he was going to, you know, quote unquote, in the audience's mind, briefly die? And be reborn. And it seems to me, unless I'm calculating it wrong and I'm a little sleep deprived, it seems to be an end of act one type of situation.
When they're starting to, it's really when they start to go off after Claw, when they're heading out to Busan.
It's when they're heading to Busan.
Yeah, so they're going, they know Claw exists and they know Claw's out there.
So that's end of act one. Okay.
And that's end of act one, our hero heading out into the world.
And so is Black Panther dying end of act two?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's the low point.
But so you realized at what point that you were gonna do that plot device, because it worked great.
I think we always wanted to show, and this is something that Ryan was really adamant about, this idea of superheroes that aren't all so vulnerable, so invincible that you never have stakes, and you always at some point know that it's going to work out, you know. And so we wanted to really show, again, personally, T'Challa's vulnerability and confusion, trying to, you know, kind of root him and ground him, you know, in a human way, but also to show that he, you know, he was vulnerable to die, and what are the stakes of that? If you believe he's literally dead, what does that mean for our story? And so the tension that it creates when they fight at the end, and for every other character after he gets thrown off the waterfall, was something that we again knew fairly early on we were going to do. We getting to that point and the mechanics from that, you know, were things we were working out, but we knew that was something that was going to happen.
You were co-writing, obviously, with the director, so you had complete access. Was there anything during production that you found yourself needing to do any sort of a rewrite for, and how involved were you during production?
No, honestly, it was interesting, and it was a pretty awesome compliment when we got through in December when we handed in our. Would be the draft right before we start production in January, and you're hoping that it's gonna be okay, and there's not gonna be like, oh my God, we still have so much work to do while we're shooting. They didn't feel that way. They felt like it was in really strong shape, and really what was going on during in terms of production writing was Ryan doing rehearsals and working with the actors and tweaking and doing things.
How long
like
of a
that.
Rehearsal period did he have?
Well, he would, you know, he would do rehearsals, you know, I'm talking about like rehearsals, you know, while they're shooting.
Oh, okay, okay.
I'm talking about, you know, like tweaking and like, it was that sort of thing. But he was rehearsing. He did quite a bit of rehearsing during pre-production. You know, I wasn't in rehearsal. So, you know, but he would, when we would talk, he'd say, oh, we discovered something great in rehearsal today. Let's look.
Was there something you remember?
No.
So you knew I was going to go.
I'm not doing that.
Right.
You ask great questions, but I'm sorry, I can't answer them all.
No. It's all good. Editing is the last stage of storytelling.
Yep.
Well, what did you learn through the editing process, and were there any scenes that you really missed that didn't even end up on the Blu-ray? Because there's a few deleted scenes there.
Man, I'm not sure if there's anything that I really miss. I didn't look on the Blu-ray at the deleted scenes either. So I'm like, I'd have to. Do you remember what was on there?
Of course.
Yeah, what was on there? And I'll tell you whether I'm like if it was like a scene that I was like, oh man, because I mean, when I watched the movie,
Some of it were just extra bits, you know, like a longer, the CIA agent telling him, you know, how's it going to be before he goes to the UN.
Right.
There weren't any major scenes on the DVD. That's kind of why I was asking.
Yeah, I don't feel like there was anything where I'm like, oh. I mean,
there was a longer chat with Okoye and her husband.
Oh yeah, that was after in the throne room.
Yeah,
that was a lovely. It was, you know, that scene was a little bit short. It was a lovely scene, but the way it plays in a movie is great. You know, sometimes less is more. So you know,
was there anything modular? Was there anything that they shifted that was in a different order that kind of you're like, oh, why didn't we think of shifting it like that? Because I always love hearing about those.
Sure, trying to figure out where Killmonger was introduced. It was lots of different places and trying to like, how early do you show him in the museum? How late, like where? So I know that shifted around. I don't think where it landed was where it ultimately was in the script. And so like stuff like that, just his arc was something I think that felt pretty modular because you're trying to introduce him, but not give away too much. You know, because you want to.
You're telling it in flashbacks when he takes the herb and goes to the ancestral plane as well.
Yeah.
Tell us about finding the right ending, because you have a very complicated ending. You have the thematic argument taking place on the train stabilizer tracks where their suits and powers are kind of ebbing and flowing. Or not their powers, their suits.
Yeah.
As the train goes by, you have an entire war going on outside. So tell us about finding that ending.
Well, you know, this is a ghost of the wish fulfillment thing. You want the action, right? It's part of what these, you know, what superhero movies are. You have the big action, but the most effective films it's the emotional battle. The one-on-one battle is the one that like affects us the most. And so we try to balance the two. We try to, you know, and there's a lot of characters to service too. So you want to give everybody their moment.
There's a sister. There's everything going on in the battlefield. Yeah. There was a lot going on there.
Yeah, and so you know, it was a constant kind of like, well, what if we try this? What if we try that? How, you know, what version of this, you know, heroic in beat for character so and so is too much, or you know, do we pull back? Do we, you know? So, but we knew that T'Challa and Eric were going to be battling in the mine for sure. That one-on-one thing, we knew it was really just what's the mechanics of getting them down there and getting everyone else in their position, and what, you know, what was the resolution between Okoye and, you know, and her lover and all, just all of that became.
It's difficult because writers love a scene like that. Your antagonists and protagonists are coming together in battle, not just as they did before, the face-off before, because since he didn't yield, this was technically a continuation of the challenge, as he said.
Yeah.
And there's a tendency for some writers to, you know, it's gravy. Everybody loves it. So you want to have these like monologues back and forth at each other. But that wasn't what in this finished version of the film we saw. Yeah. They were very terse about their words, but it was a very specific continuation of the arguments of their fathers. And I'm curious if there were longer versions that you guys dealt with and some of the difficulties of really shaping it down to just be as lean and mean as it is.
Yes. The short answer is yes, there were longer versions. And you're really trying as you know, even in the writing process of editing down, I'm sure in the directing process, editing it down with the actors, and then and in, you know, in post, you're trying to get to the essence of what the characters are saying and what they feel, and so, you know, the first versions of those, I'm sure they were big blocks of, because you're trying to like work through, like, you know, a lot of kind of things, some that are very heady and some, you know, and so you're kind of constantly trying to find the right words to make it emotional, but also kind of,
well, it's healthy to write the long version. Yeah. So then you have something that you could cut down.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that does make sense. But you know, one thing I've got to ask about that battle is the dialogue, like the death speech of Killmonger is just like, I wrote it down 'cause I didn't want to misquote it. Just bury me in the ocean with my ancestors who jumped from ships because they knew death was better than bondage. Yeah. Tell us about that line, because there's so much power in that line.
Well, it was. It was. I'll say this. It was a line that when I say Marvel was really supportive, it was a line we didn't know whether it would stay, and it was one of their favorite lines in the first draft. It was in there the first draft, and so
that's awesome.
Yeah,
that's awesome, and that's awesome. They supported it. You know, every writer has something that's personal to them. What was your most personal moment in this movie? On the page.
I love the, you know, I really love the ancestral plane scenes. You know, and working on those were, I love that duality. I love that, the way we were able to explore this idea of what, the orphan version, you know, the Killmonger version not being connected, and then the Wakanda version of protective of what, you know, this like that, but two fathers with their child. And, you know, I didn't grow up with a father. And so for me, those scenes were very, meaningful to work on. So yeah.
What was your toughest scene? What was the scene as a writer you kept battling and had to come back to again and again? And how did you creatively tackle the challenge?
You know, I would say it wasn't a scene in particular, but like, I would think, you know, honestly, the ending of the film, like working through, trying to really get to what you were describing, get those later debates and those scenes where once, you know, Killmonger has taken over and he's talking about his approach and how he wants to change Wakanda. And then once T'Challa comes back and just like the philosophical nature of those scenes that also need to be emotional, and just trying to find the balance and trying to really make those scenes work and not be too heavy handed, but not also not give short service to things that are more weighty, you know, and just really trying to make that work. You know, it's a lot of trial and error. There's a lot of stuff that wasn't right, and you just keep working at it and try to get it.
Were there any reshoots that were important for you that you guys needed to write?
I know we did. No, I mean, we did some reshoots, but
all films have reshoots.
Yeah, but
bad about it.
We did reshoots, but it wasn't. There was no big substantial.
So they were just functional.
Yeah, it was all functional stuff.
Okay. You know, there's this other little movie that came out after yours, Avengers Infinity War. there's a lot of it that takes place in Wakanda. And yeah. I'm curious, because Marvel's so good at integrating, mm-hmm. at what point did they start saying, hey, you know, we're planning on doing this later on, it might be nice if? Or was there anything about Infinity War coming on?
I knew that they were going to be there at a certain point. But I wasn't, you know, like Ryan would have had more of those conversations than I would have. You kind of know that they'll be doing something there, but I never was aware of what it was.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're going to take a question or two from the crowd, because
sure.
I know we're getting towards the end. Right there in the red jacket. Great question. He had heard that this was your first time co-writing, and what was something that you took forward from working with Ryan that you would maybe use as part of your creative habit?
He won't, like with lines of dialogue that if it's not exactly right, you just keep at it. So there would be lots of alts. We come up with alts, and I'm kind of an organic writer. If it feels right, I kind of go, okay, I'm gonna move on. I'll read it again later and see we would be at certain, once we got really into it, we'd just be really trying to really get everything out of that line that we could. And that was a great for me, because it was a different way of looking at specific dialogue and specific scenes, you know, kind of really staying with one line over and over. And it made the movie better. And so I think that would be the way to answer
that. Right there, you, sir, on the aisle. His question was regard to things you picked up in the Marvel program, especially about tracking, emotional tracking and spectacle, and merging them together.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. It's it is what I think you find when they're at their Marvel movies are at their best. It's action that is secondary to character. So there's character beats embedded in the action. And so when you're watching a sequence, you're more interested in the person or the character going through that, so that the stakes immediately are higher, and it and you are in that character's point of view, and so you feel more of what they're feeling, so their action feels more impactful. And so when you're dealing with movies that rely on action, they're very, very good at really rooting you into it in a way that other movies may not. Yeah.
Look, it's really too bad that after all this work, such good work, Thanos just snapped and it's just all worthless now.
All
like
over.
There's no future,
it's
you
all,
know?
If you start evaporating,
it's very sad. Yeah, it's very sad. So much good work and there just can't be a future. Look, congrats on your WGA nomination.
Thank
You've been so generous with your time. Give it up again for Joe.
All right. And I have to say, so my wife doesn't kick my butt, that we were married during that time. I'm so sorry.
Saved. Safe. Thanks again.
And that's how the Q&A went down. Special thanks again to co-writer Joe Robert Cole for coming down to chat about his WGA and Oscar-nominated film, Black Panther. Of course, don't forget to visit our sponsor, the fine folks at ScreenCraft, and save 10% off your application fee at ScreenCraft.org by using code QAPODCAST, all one word, QAPODCAST, at ScreenCraft.org, and you could save 10% on your application to the ScreenCraft Film Fund, or even a chance to win the ScreenCraft Screenwriting Fellowship and sign with a top agency. So don't forget to type in QA Podcast at ScreenCraft.org to save 10% when you apply. And folks, we recently published issue 35 of Backstory Magazine, and it features a Vice cover story with writer-director Adam McKay chatting about his truly original screenplay. Plus, issue 35 also has in-depth articles on Aquaman, Mary Poppins Returns, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, and our huge Nickel Fellowship piece where we meet the 2018 winners, plus so much more. So I hope you look at the table of contents so you can see everything that's inside issue 35. And if you like what you see, I hope you consider subscribing. If you're on the fence, you could read issue number 1, the free issue, and test drive us at backstory.net as well. So I hope you'll check it out. And hey, if you're in LA, you're going to visit LA, make sure to sign up for my screening series so you could come to these events, as we're happy to have you. You could sign up to get on the free email list at backstory.net/events, so I hope to see you at a screening sometime soon. The Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith is a copyright of Unlikely Films Incorporated in 2019. All rights reserved. And hey, if you'd like to show your support and donate to this free podcast so I can continue to buy new equipment and use these funds to pay all of my podcast hosting fees, feel free to send a PayPal virtual tip to yogoldsmith@gmail.com. Any amount is greatly appreciated. As for your social networking needs, you could follow Yo Goldsmith on Twitter or could check out my Facebook fan page. I'm Jeff Goldsmith, the publisher of Backstory and the host of the Q&A, thanking you for tuning in and telling you to stay out of trouble. Till next week.